Hey everyone, this is Patrick Gray here at Risky.biz with part two of our Snake Oilers Special Edition. This isn't our weekly show. This is something we do four times a year. We get a bunch of vendors together and they explain their tech. Last week, I published interviews with CrowdStrike, Replicated, and Attack IQ. Go check those out if you haven't already. But I wanted to break out these two companies into their own podcast. This podcast deals with authentication technology. In particular, if you manage a Windows network, you'll want to listen to this and get an idea of some of the different approaches for solving some of your auth challenges. I will mention that this is a sponsored podcast. Everyone who participates in Snake Oilers has paid to be a part of it. And yeah, in this edition, we're going to hear from two companies, Remediant and Yubico. Yubico, of course, makes YubiKeys, the hardware authentication device used by companies like Google and Facebook to lock down accounts. I own one and I paid my own money for it. A lot of security people use these USB devices because they just work really, really well. Now, what I didn't know, because I'm a dumbass, is there's actually native support for YubiKeys in Windows. So if you want to add hardware-backed two-factor authentication into your Windows accounts, this is one way to do that. So that's a really interesting chat we're going to have with Yubico a little bit later on. But before we talk to them, we're going to hear from Remediant. Remediant is a startup that also makes some very interesting Windows authentication technology. Now, a lot of Risky Business listeners operate in high security or compliance heavy environments. This will often mean that they're using password vault tech for better privileged account management. Now, Remediant has something that they think is a better approach. Basically, they've created a tech that lets you enable and disable privileged accounts on like a time lock basis. If you have to do some admin work on a box, you log into your Remediant server, you enable that account for a set period of time, and then off you go. It's quite easy. It's a very light touch way of solving some pretty serious management headaches, and it's very easy to audit, which will keep our friends in the heavily regulated environments very happy. Lockheed Martin uses Remediant's tech internally, so people operating in high security environments like it as well. Remediant also says it can do a one-day POC audit of your Windows privileged accounts, and they'll show you how badly over-provisioned you are when it comes to privileged accounts. So yeah, that could be a scary afternoon. Anyway, I asked Remediant's chief executive, Tim Keeler, to explain what they're actually selling. Here he is.
It's really two things, and it's two simple things. The first is continuous monitoring of all of your admin accounts. And when I talk about continuous monitoring, I really mean near real-time insight. So anytime a new administrator pops up on an endpoint, we will detect that change, even if it's down in Active Directory group that is nested four layers down. We'll pick up on that, and we can give a one-to-one correlation for what administrator has access to what systems on the network, right? That's real visibility. No one else really does that today. The second part is just-in-time administration. So what we've realized is, administrators typically have 24/7 access to tens of thousands of systems, and we know that creates a lot of risk, and we try to mitigate that. But there's a lot of ways around password vaults. So without having that continuous monitoring, it's really important. Now, with just-in-time administration, what we're doing is we start with the zero trust model, and the zero trust principle is nobody should have administrative access to all these endpoints, because when they need to log into systems, they only really need that access for a limited amount of time. So we time box that access, and we make it really easy for administrators to log onto a web portal using two-factor authentication. And that way they can dynamically request access to server A or server B. And if they need 4 hours, we'll give them access for 4 hours. And then we'll take that back away. So kind of the baseline is zero trust. And when we follow this principle down to the very endpoint level, we stop lateral movement altogether.
So as I understand it, you've got a web gateway, a web-based gateway that you set up, well, inside an organization. So it's not actually on the web, but you set up a little thing with a web interface within the organization, and that communicates to endpoints. Is that communicating to an endpoint agent?
No, and that's the great part about it, is we're all about scale and quick deployments. So it's literally a single U appliance that you pop into your data center, and it will actively make connections out to all the different workstations and servers on your network. We do this without agents, and we do this without needing any type of escalated privilege. And that's how we're able to inventory and learn about all of the administrative members on each of the different endpoints.
So how do you fiddle privilege without privilege?
Yeah. So when you enable Protect Mode, what we do is we use a local admin account, right? It's our local service admin account that is uniquely provisioned on every single system. And when we have that ability with the local administrative rights using our Secure One service account, we can then manage all the other members within that work group. So we'll take administrators out of the local admin group. And then when they go through our portal using two-factor authentication, we'll take those users and we follow that same user's identity and we push that user's account back into the local administrative group on the server or the system that they're trying to access just for the amount of time they need.
So I'm thinking there's a bunch of people listening to this who are thinking, great, this all sounds really, really good, but how do I do a vulnerability scan? How do I, what do I do about my service accounts? You know, obviously we can't give, just-in-time access to service accounts. Now I'm guessing, Tim, well, I'm not really guessing because you've already told me about this, but let's just go with that. I'm guessing that the way that you handle service accounts is really down to the predictability of service accounts, and you can just monitor them to look for issues. So what, you allow service accounts to continue having privilege? Is that how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, service accounts is a major challenge for companies dealing, anytime they have privileged access, right? It's like, okay, how do you reduce or limit that, but still get the functionality out there? We are kind of a DevOps company first. And what we do is we kind of model in that DevOps scenario where we build our technology from the API and the ground up. So it's really easy to integrate your application into our technology. And essentially what we do with service accounts is we'll dynamically provision service accounts as they need privilege. So you mentioned vulnerability scanners. That's kind of a classic scenario. So if you're running vulnerability scans once a week, once a month, or once a quarter, you don't need that account having 24/7 persistent admin access on all these different endpoints. And so what we do is just with two simple API calls, we're able to, before the vulnerability scanner starts its job, say, hey, we're going to take that service account and we're going to push that account into the local administrative group on all the different systems that you're targeting. That way the vulnerability scanner runs, it will go collect and do whatever it needs to do. And then at the end, we will automatically, with another API call, say, okay, we're done using the service account, then we'll take that back out.
What about other types of service accounts that might need more regular forms of access, like backup agents and things like that? How do you deal with that problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you do have a service account that requires, we need this always having 24/7 rights, what we do is we allow persistent access for those accounts. So you can do that through our API, you can do that through our web interface. You can basically say, okay, let's leave these service accounts always in the admin group, and then you just manage kind of the risk profile associated with that account. I mean, service accounts, they always have this kind of predictable nature, this predictable chain. So we tie this in with kind of the UBA approach and saying, okay, well, now we can make sure that that service account is just only coming from these sets of IP addresses or from these sets of box, or they're only, providing this type of access to different systems. So this way, if those accounts ever get compromised, we can more intelligently kind of monitor and report out on that to say, hey, something suspicious might be going on with this account.
Yeah, so if your backup agent starts trying to go places it's never been before, you might want to throw up a couple of whoop, whoop.
Yeah, absolutely, right? It's like, oh, why is the backup agent trying to log on to, this HR server or something that has financial data, things like that.
So Tim, sell me on the deployment side of this. Like you say it's easy. Convince me.
Yeah, so we really want to make it as super easy as possible for the administrators. Administrators hate going into a password vault, checking out a shared account, and that also, it gives you a lot of regulatory compliance and audit problems, right? When you're not able to easily reconcile, hey, what user had access to the shared account? So we kind of rely off of this core principle that things should be done using that user's own identity. So rather than having an administrator go through and check out an alternate set of credentials, when we perform an action, we will push that own user's identity into the local admin group. So when they're logging onto systems, it's still using their own identity. And we want to make that just really easy to do within the web interface. And administrators actually really like using our tool because it's literally typing in the name of the system that they're targeting and clicking one system and says, hey, give me access for the next 4 hours.
Now, some people listening, and we did address this when you guys did a weekly show not too long ago, but probably worth touching on again. Some people might be saying, hey, this sounds great, but if your 1RU unit that does all this access provisioning gets owned, that's going to be pretty bad. In fact, when I was talking about your tech on Twitter, Dave Itell actually replied and said, well, you know, who pen tested their appliance? Your answer to that was actually Lockheed Martin's red team, which is a good answer, I'm guessing, right? Because they use this internally, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're one of our largest customers and largest deployments. And obviously, for the types of data that they're working with is extremely sensitive. So they take security very seriously, and they have one of the best red teams out there. So we are actually quite surprised, you know, because they came back to us and said, hey, you know, most vendors get beat up with our red testing. This is just part of the normal process. And we came out quite unscathed. And that was something really eye-opening for us because, you know, obviously we're a group of, you know, security people who take this stuff extremely serious. But to have, you know, a very credible company out there and say, hey, your technology is rock solid and we like how you guys are thinking and approaching security was really telling for us.
Well, I'm guessing too that, you know, you can get the surface area of something like this down to a pretty manageable size from an attack surface area point of view, right?
Yeah, I mean, we run as a hardened Linux appliance. We've actually spent quite a bit of time reverse engineering a lot of Windows-specific API calls that we have part of our core intellectual property. So we can do things really quickly and we can scale really fast. So, you know, we're talking 100,000 plus systems is kind of very trivial for us to scan very quickly on a network. And we've actually gotten this down to about 5 network packets in between maybe 1 to 200 milliseconds for a whole operation of inventorying the admin accounts on a system.
Can someone go and get a hold of this tech and deploy it as a trial?
Yeah, we do this all the time, right? We do these quick one-day POCs, which, you know, there's not a telling story when you get to see your own data, right? So we'll actually jump on site with my laptop or one of our SE's laptops, plug it into the network and say, okay, we just need a basic user account and we'll start scanning your network. And what companies are usually surprised about is we come back and we give them kind of the profile of, hey, here's all the administrators that can log onto all these different systems. And it's eye-opening because there's a lot of administrator over-provisioning that goes on out there and companies just aren't aware of it. And that's because there aren't any tools out there that really give you that level of visibility and insight. And, you know, we're talking in a single hour, we can inventory, you know, quite a large network.
All right, Tim Keeler, the technology is called Remediant. There is a link in the show notes for this podcast, or you could just go to remediant.com and check them out for all your privileged account management needs. Tim Keeler, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. Great to be here.
That was Tim Keeler of Remediant there. Do check them out at remediant.com. Okay, our next vendor is Yubico. Yubico, spelled Y-U-B-I-C-O, makes the YubiKey, a second factor authentication device. Basically, it's a little computer on a USB stick that works more or less like a smart card, so they can't be cloned, and they're based on the U2F standard. A lot of people in InfoSec use YubiKeys already, even for their personal accounts. Both Facebook and Google let users lock down their accounts with YubiKeys. I have one on my desk in front of me. I think I mentioned that at the top of the show. YubiKeys are great. But what I didn't know is that they're natively supported in Windows since Windows 7. So instead of having to roll out some awful third-party software stack, you can buy yourself a bunch of YubiKeys for like, I think they're like $40 or $50 a pop. But I mean, obviously that's going to depend on the volume that you're buying them in. But yeah, you just buy them and you start using them. For a lot of enterprises, that's going to solve some of their problems right away. Yubico's VP of Solutions, Jared Chong, joined me to talk about what enterprise users are actually doing with YubiKeys. Here's what he had to say.
So there are four major areas that enterprise customers use a YubiKey for. First, computer logon. Second, web applications, which is, you know, you would do that as well as a consumer, which is getting to Facebook. But in an enterprise setting, you would also get to web applications. Then it's also very common to add on to be remote access, which is VPN, RDP, and all these VDI systems that you want to get to. And then the fourth sort of use case that we really seen a huge uptick is privileged access as well. So a typical enterprise deployment would involve usually one or more of these use cases that the customers would want to solve. And it would also involve one or more protocols that YubiKey can perform. So it can definitely do the OTP, as that's been our bread and butter for a while. But it also can do smart cards. So today, the latest generation is a smart card as well. So it is both the reader as well a card. And I think the industry has heard the term security key. I know I've heard it on your show many times, or recently quite a number of times. And it's also a security key, so it's a FIDO security key. So because it can work with different authentication protocols, you can actually solve that with different backends of systems to solve the various use cases, which is computer logon, web applications, remote access, or privileged access.
So let's talk about how you would go about rolling out YubiKeys to say, you know, every account on a Windows network. I mean, how do you do that? I'd imagine that, okay, sure, you're very well known for making these devices. Most people know the devices from, you know, consumer services. But if you're an enterprise authentication group, like what's involved in switching over and using something like YubiKey for authentication?
One of the nice things about what we try to do is we are a hardware device. We sell a YubiKey to the customers, and the customers would distribute these to the employees, and they would use this physically with the device that they want to log into, say for a computer. One of the key areas that we try to really work on is to work with existing systems that customers already own. So what do we mean by that is that we work really hard to support these multiple various protocols that we have on the YubiKey. They all work out of standards-based authentication protocol. So for example, in the smart card world, we work with the PIF standard, which is a very common smart card standard in the US. And interestingly enough, it ships with every single Windows 7 box and above. And we plug right straight into the Microsoft ecosystem if you're going to deploy smart cards with Microsoft, which means that if you had a Microsoft AD, which I would say 99% of enterprise customers have some type of Microsoft environment, then it would be more of a configuration effort to get the YubiKeys to work with something that the customers have already bought. So a very typical deployment of YubiKeys as a smart card is to configure your Microsoft ADCS, your certificate services, to enable provisioning of user certs onto the YubiKey. And once you do that, the next time you log into the computer, if you're the user, you plug it in. Instead of putting your username and password, you would actually put in a PIN. And once you put in the PIN, it uses the user cert that has been provisioned by the Microsoft ADCS. You would just log into your computer straight into the domain.
So this is interesting, right? Because, you know, I didn't actually know, and it makes total sense, by the way, this is just me derping out, but I had no idea that you actually had native support for your devices. So this isn't some sort of, you know, horrible enterprise software stack that you have to install on, you know, your auth servers. It's just, you know, you just have to configure them using existing functionality to accept authentication from your devices. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think that's what really comes to the core of what we try to do. We try to make it as simple as it is for the users. But also, when we say simplicity, we talk about scale. And the only way you get scale is when you work with an open ecosystem that is based on industry standards, right? It's easy to use a YubiKey. We don't just mean use it as in users. Of course, that's what people know us from a consumer side. But easy means also easy for enterprise to deploy them. And the reason we do that is we work really hard with the OS and platform vendors and to make sure that they support some open standard that is an authentication open standard or identity open standard so that devices can just work out of the box. What people really are, I would say, tired of in the industry, as you know, I'm sure you talk to many of your customers and audience, is they're tired of this vendor lock-in situation. Now, while we say, okay, well, we could use YubiKey and you lock into using YubiKey, but if we follow an open standard, or we follow something that's kind of built into the OS or the platform, then if we're not doing our job building the right YubiKeys, people could switch. And so that's really what I believe the industry needs, which is more open collaboration and interoperability and less of this proprietary type of like black box magic voodoo. So the more that industry can work together, we believe that that's the right strategy to actually up the game for security everywhere.
How many YubiKeys are actually out there in the wild right now? Because I'm guessing it's quite a few.
It's quite a few. I think this is coming to our 10th year as a company. So we've hit our 10th year mark. The founders moved here to the Silicon Valley 2012, around there. So I would say that's when the uptick of YubiKeys really, really picked up. So I would say in the millions, several millions.
So do you have many organizations like banks rolling out YubiKeys to their customers to actually, you know, protect those customers and in turn by protecting their customers, protect themselves? Is that a use case that's common?
It is a growing use case. I would say the banks are generally cautious of newer type now technology. Interestingly, we've been in business for 10 years, so we consider the technology fairly new. I can look at it from a different angle. So if you look at what we've done, we've said, okay, it's important to sell to the enterprises, which is part of our business. But it's also important that once we sell to the enterprise, if they believe that what they're providing for individual employees is important, then they should offer this to not just, say, their suppliers or the vendors that they work with, but it's important that they offer this type of authentication to their customers as well. So this natural type of evolution, working with their internal employees and then maybe their suppliers and then to the customers, is what we've seen already happen. We've done this work with the Google folks, where we actually work with Google to sell to Google for their internal use. And then it grew all the way outside, which is now everybody who has a Gmail account can actually use a YubiKey to get into Gmail. And it's the same technology that we'd use inside the enterprise. Banks, I would say, is there are several banks. I can't talk about them because of various NDAs. But there are banks that that have offered these to their customers in what we call closed distribution because of the way they've had policies around this thing. But with Jenny, as an uptick, a lot of services now are planning to support the FIDO U2F standard, which is the security keys in their services, because it's just deemed to be a much stronger, more efficient, privacy-preserving, modern authentication protocol for the web. So the movement to move from enterprise to consumers and consumers back to enterprise is really what has created the whole buzz with the YubiKeys.
Now, if my employer gives me a YubiKey, you know, for use internally on their network, can I then use that YubiKey to and set that up with my personal Gmail and Facebook account? I mean, do you require one key per service, or I'm guessing you can use the one key for multiple services?
The multiple authentication protocols on the YubiKey has different sets of capabilities for how it works with different services. So if your employer decides to issue a YubiKey and does not lock things down, which some of them do, then you could. And we believe that that should be the right model. And the reason is very simple. There is several protocols, particularly the FIDO U2F protocol, which is a privacy-preserving protocol, which means that if you provision a credential with one service and you provision another credential for a different service with the same YubiKey, the two services don't know it's from the same YubiKey. Because of that type of modern approach to authentication, it shouldn't stop any companies from allowing their users to use it with, I would say, consumer services. And the way we look at it is very simple. Good security hygiene start at home. Now, if your employers give the opportunity for the employees to use it at home and they are just doing it every day, then they would be just much more aware of just how to use security products when they get into the organization. So good hygiene at home really continues to translate to good hygiene within the enterprise environment.
That makes absolute 100% sense, but it is up to the organizations, is it, whether or not they lock the YubiKeys to certain internal services and they say, no, this is your work YubiKey, you can't use it for anything else.
That is true. So ultimately, it falls on the policy of the customers. We do advocate for having a more open policy, but yes, ultimately it's up to the customer. So sometimes we do have users saying, here's my personal YubiKey, and then here's my corporate YubiKey. They look the same, so I differentiated them with some nail polish.
One thing we didn't cover, Jared, is actually how you would go about using one of these in a web application that you might design, right? So, you know, we mentioned, our banks using them and things like that. Say I'm designing a web application for my enterprise. I've got a lot of high-value users. I want to make sure that those accounts are very, very secure and it's well within my budget to provision a hardware token to those users. How do I then actually integrate something like a U2F, you know, YubiKey, into my web app? Is that do you provide a developer kit, or again, is this all relying on standard libraries and things?
So when we talk about the FIDO U2F protocol, it's an open standard which we co-created with Google. So we have a lot of libraries on how to create your own servers. There are obviously commercial out-the-box products, what we call FIDO authentication servers, But if you're a big bang, you probably want to first investigate the protocol, and second of all, investigate the open source tools that we have. We have a lot of open source libraries as well as reference servers. So most big banks or most mixed services, they would actually review all our code on GitHub and ask us questions like, how does this work? Why does it work this way? And we actually give guidance on that. And we do give them keys to test. We also give them help if they run into some challenges. And sometimes it's an interesting combination of they've got something unique in the environment that they need to address. For example, one of the interesting discussions about how should they think about recovery in this new model? Or how should they think about what the experience is going from different type of browsers and OSs or devices? And we give them guidance on how we've seen other people do it. You know, obviously, we work with some of the big ones already in the recent years, like, you know, Google, Dropbox, Facebook. So we've kind of got a pretty good sense of what it is to implement this service from a scalability perspective. But every business has their own requirements. So we try to work with them using what's existing out there. And typically, all the software that we give to the customers are more or less open source and free.
Jared Chong, thank you very much for joining us here on Risky Business to have a chat about YubiKey stuff. I'm a big fan. I've got one sitting on my desk in front of me. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
That was Jared Chong of Yubico there. And there you go, an open standards-backed second factor hardware device that fits on your keyring and is natively supported by Windows. And you can use it for your Facebook and your Gmail accounts. So I think I've said enough. You can find them at yubico.com, spelled Y-U-B-I-C-O.com. And that is it for this edition of Snake Oilers. The next round of Snake Oilers interviews will kick off in November. If you are interested in participating, do email sales@risky.biz. I'll be back in the weekly show in a couple of days, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. We'll